It's June 2nd, 2019. You're listening to Fancy Ramen, episode 120. Title pending? Hell Baby?
Hell Baby.
I'm going to leave this one up to you.
On this week of the Fancy Ramen podcast, just be sure to listen to me talk about the terrible, terrible mistakes I've made.
We talk about Maniac, the Netflix series, Chernobyl, the HBO series, Death Stranding's latest trailer.
And then we get to hear Neil dig into the complexities behind Phoenix Wright, Ace Attorney, Total War, Three Kingdoms. You have a little bit to say about Persona 3 Portable and the adaptations that it's made to the original Persona 3 and Persona FES games. And finally, we stake out our position of which house each of us will take in Fire Emblem Three Houses.
Here's a hint. Scott's gonna be a boy.
So, welcome back to another exciting episode of Fancy Ramen. What have you guys been up to this past week or two?
Oh, yeah. Take it away, Cookie.
I have been harnessing that big deck energy to continue working on my deck, which is now almost complete. At least most of the floorboards are done, and we are now working on getting the stairs installed. Besides that, I kind of started / joined a band. We are the Bear Market. It's some dudes at TD Ameritrade that play music instruments, and we're going to be performing a concert at some point for TD Ameritrade employees during work hours. So, yeah. So we've been kind of practicing.
Bear Market is bad, right? Or they're
just
negative?
It's a down market. It's a seller's market.
So you're not going with the B-E-A-R Bear Market, because that seems like it could be a fun time.
Yes, they're
I
big
I
want to
say
paint.
That's actually how bear is spelled with a bear market.
I'm guessing
no,
it's B-A-R-E.
I think it's bull and bear is in the animals.
Yeah, no, it's B-A-R-E. B-E-A-R. It's as the animal. Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because the other market's a bull market, which is an up market or a buyer's
but
market.
When you did say B-A-R-E, I was excited that a naked market was essentially the implication.
Oh my God. So I'm in charge of designing our logo. Mm-hmm. So now I'm thinking of like a naked bear walking into a Costco wearing MeUndies.
We're not getting sponsored by MeUndies, so.
We're not, but I've
our
already
3 minutes of gold have been just MeUndies talk.
Nice.
Not exactly, but I'm just saying we are piloting a potential ad pitch. So for those listening in the podcast world, they can now see what their sponsorship will yield. Because we are desperate for that advertiser cash.
Yep.
True debt.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Like,
so that's kind of been
going to happen. So that's
Yeah, you're lacking faith in the wide market
spectrum.
Fancy Ramen targets as its consumer market.
Heggs, yeah. But yeah, that's pretty much been my past 2 weeks. Has just been, you know, working on the deck and not really working on the deck at the same time.
Well, we did have an episode last week, so.
Well, we did, but we also didn't talk about anything aside from Game of Thrones, basically.
Which is true, which honestly, we should have just played that 36-minute video that you sent me and Cookie that was essentially a breakdown of why people are feeling as though the Game of Thrones essentially kind of collapsed in the last couple seasons. Which, long story short, it was hard for us to say, but I think it's absolutely true. Because we went from character development and operating in like moral grays that allowed everybody to appreciate and understand the nuances of characters to like black and white characters that made downright illogical decisions to fit like a stereo or archetype of that particular character.
But
that's it.
enough and, of but Game of Thrones no talks. More. That's dead. That's gone. Maybe George will finish the books now that, you know, he doesn't have to compete with the show, so to speak. Have you guys been watching any other new shows to fill that bit of time you spent on Game of Thrones?
We absolutely have. By we, I mean me. I guess I won't draw a cookie into this unless he has, in fact, been watching something else.
I have.
But I picked up... actually, since I've talked about what I've been watching, I picked up and finished Maniac on Netflix, which was a really delightful show that I kind of slept on, but I knew I would like, or it seemed like I would enjoy it when I first heard about it. It has Emma Stone and Jonah Hill, and it is this very kind of surreal dive into two characters that are both suffering from mental illness in one form or another. And the series just has some like really phenomenal character acting by those two. And upon completing it, I went back and did the, with a lot of shows that have like recursive elements or themes that they can continuously bring up, I actually went and rewatched the first episode and saw just how many like tiny Easter eggs and things are like hidden in the background. And I have to say that the show was an absolute delight. It's one of those that I don't feel super confident talking about without spoiling things. But if movies like Inception or Paprika, like the exploration essentially of the like unconscious mind, are interesting to someone, I think Maniac is like a must watch. I just really loved it.
So when you say Easter eggs early on in the series, are you talking about like foreshadowing or things that should be flags for what the ultimate conclusion or spoiler or twist in the series is?
When I say Easter eggs in particular, I am talking about things that come up later in the show that you wonder exactly where they come from, there are multiple different types of things that you encounter by, say, like rewatching the first episode. You'll notice things that were actually like anchor points to the story or really relevant items that their introduction or origin, depending if you're paying enough attention or not, just kind of like slip in through the background in the first episode, while there are other things that you just see going on in the background or are just kind of obscured in a scene that reappear later more prominently in the exploration of these like characters' minds. So you get to see the same way you get to see the things that are being introduced into, say, like a character's dream state. When you have a dream and you think about it later, if you think about the day that you had beforehand, sometimes you can relate certain elements of the dream that have been warped or twisted or even blown out of proportion that have happened in your daily life. And they do actually a really cool job with that by introducing a lot of stuff in the first episode that are essentially exposed to that effect of your mind essentially distorting them in one way or another.
How long is the series? 12 episodes, 10 episodes?
I think it's 10 episodes. Each episode is actually very diverse in its length. There was one I watched that was just a little over 30 minutes. There's another one I watched that was over an hour. So it's actually it's something I really like about these streaming services too. They're not committed to any sort of time slot. And I think a lot of shows have still operated under, we're going to write 45-minute shows, and that's going to be this whole season. Maybe for a finale, we'll extend it. But for Maniac, it really does seem like it's like, whatever we need to tell for this act, we're going to have that much length. And so if it's a shorter act, we're not going to use that much screen time. And episode 4 is going to be half the length of episode 9. Which works really well, actually. You don't have to add filler to episodes that can be a little more streamlined or bare bones. And for the episodes that you really need that extra length, it's an available option. There's no binding to a time slot.
So you're telling me that we don't need to have a shot of some bar hand sweeping the floors for 7 minutes while we wait for the credits.
Are you talking about David Lynch?
Yeah, Twin Peaks season 3. Okay. So yeah. where would one find Maniac, and is it exclusive to that service?
They're going to find it on Netflix, and it is an original to Netflix, so it will be exclusive to the service.
How do you think it compares to 13 Reasons Why?
Reasons Why. Better.
Better in like a way that 13 Reasons Why.
You want me to elaborate?
No, it's just like I never got around to watching 13 Reasons Why or completing it. I kind of felt a little like the subject matter itself wasn't taken seriously in a way that it was and wasn't. It's hard for me to explain, but it
oscillates or like switches between the two, right? Sometimes you're like, wow, they're taking this very seriously. They're giving it like the gravity that it demands. And other times you're like, this seems a little dramatized or like overblown.
Right. And like I revisited at least the thought of 13 Reasons Why when like it recently came up in the news as essentially being a possible reason why like suicide rates in teens has risen in the past few years.
Yeah, I also read about that.
And so I was curious if Maniac did a better job of handling this with grace.
Maniac seems much less irresponsible. But once again, it's like I have familiarity with the subject matter and topics of 13 Reasons Why. I don't have near as much with Maniac, which means I have less sensitivity to how to approach those things with like nuance.
Sure.
Which makes me not the best person to judge that. And if there are think pieces that come out by people who have much more experience or exposure that say, Maniac's maybe not being particularly smart or responsible about this, then I'll probably listen to that advice, or I will take that into account on my perception of it. But it also, 13 Reasons Why is, how do I want to put this? The distinction between that and Maniac in this case is like 13 Reasons Why is supposed to be realistic fiction. It's a drama, and it is fiction, but all of it could happen in sort of an insane world. But Maniac is much more like Maniac both has an incredibly serious tone, but balances humor and kind of just surrealism at the same time that makes it much further from realistic fiction. It is obviously fictional in a way that brings it sort of outside of the realm of realistic fiction and almost more into the realm of a weird sci-fi alternate universe. It's not super heavy on the sci-fi in the sense that like they're trying to make all of it realistic in a sense, but the main premise is outside of the current realm of technology for sure. And especially the time that it's in the same way that Fallout takes like future technology and applies it to the design aesthetic of like the 1950s and the 1940s. Maniac takes future technology and applies it to the design aesthetic of the 80s, which makes it hideously beautiful in all of its weird boxy multicolor glory.
It sounds interesting. I'll have to check it out.
I really, really liked it. I honestly think the first episode may be the weakest one. And I have this complaint oftentimes because pilots are tricky. And it's hard to garner interest or attention in the first episode. And it's an absolute must for a show to survive or like keep viewership. But it does a lot of scene setting and setting up. And so it's one of those you have to like, you should watch the first and second episode as a pair if possible to see if you're interested or not. And I don't know how much of a time commitment that is, but it's probably about the same length of time as watching just one movie. And I think that'll really help. Because I watched the first episode, I lost interest, and then I actually came back, finished up the first episode, and then started on the second episode. And by that point in time, I was pretty interested.
If you don't mind me asking, I believe you've been watching something else, which has kind of been dubbed the next thing to watch after Game of Thrones.
Yeah, absolutely. You're probably talking about the show Chernobyl, which anybody who's been watching Game of Thrones saw that HBO was really trying to push a bunch of their other shows during the like live streaming of the new Game of Thrones episodes. So they had, you know, Deadwood and Watchmen's coming out and all this other content that they're really trying to push people on. The one that I was most interested in is Chernobyl, partially from like a fascination in nuclear chemistry, which is a really small like portion of one of my old chemistry courses that I found really fascinating. Just like seeing the, I don't know, seeing the representation of science in media is always exciting or interesting to me, especially in a historical sense, because in a modern sense, it's normally very poorly represented.
Enhance.
Yeah. And that's not even my field. Like, I needed someone else to debunk that for me. But as soon as someone explained, like, hey, this is silly, I was able to apply reason to it and think like, oh, yeah, that is kind of just stupid and absurd. But getting to see something that has, I mean, it has a lot of background information on it now, and it actually overlaps with a realm of science that I'm somewhat versed in. I was pretty interested. And I found out that sometimes when you have expertise about something, it can make an experience much more intense than if you probably don't. There is a point in the show where they're being exposed to radiation. They have they're, what pisses me off is everybody has a British accent in, you know, Ukraine and Belarus. And so
it wasn't an English staff though,
British staff. I think Sky, which is, if I remember correctly, a British like television company, Sky had a big hand in the production of the show. And so everybody's British actors. Dosimeters.
Just a quick aside. Are there any actors that have a heavy Russian accent?
No.
Okay. At least it's consistent. Because then would it not be like immersion?
Wouldn't
breaking?
It be very, very weird to have a bunch of Brits talking to Russians?
Yeah, and they're all speaking English like that.
The Brits pronouncing Russian last names, because these are all very Russian characters. It's a little weird in some ways to hear that. But my minor complaints and nuances aside, there's a point where they're the dosimeters of some characters are going off because they're being exposed to very heavy levels of gamma radiation. And the increasing frequency and intensity of the clicking like made me just like nauseously sick, just like head swimming, had to stop after that episode. Just felt like horribly, horribly ill, because as I have explained in episode 6, when I was first talking about what I used to do for work, I used to work with lethal amounts of radiation or like X-ray radiation exposure in my old job. And so I had to have radiation training, and we had to use Geiger counters in order to determine like if there was any sort of latent source of radiation in our X-ray room. And when you test those things, you actually have a piece of material that has a very, very small amount of radiation coming off of it. And it's entirely safe for you to be around it, because it's not gamma radiation coming off. I believe in this case it's alpha radiation. And so like clothing and a little like you don't need very much for protection to be safe from this type of radiation, and the amount coming off is incredibly small. but you have to test essentially this item as a control to make sure that your Geiger counter is actually working properly. And so I'm familiar with being able to use these instruments to detect. You can even get cosmic radiation. So if you have it on a high enough setting, it can, or a sensitive enough setting, it can actually detect the cosmic radiation that's literally like falling on our heads across the planet every day. You can hear it click by every once in a while. But hearing that and then hearing it reach the level of intensity and frequency that it did just made me sick to my stomach, because I've seen real images in my training of what happens when you get that amount of radiation. It's just like your body starts to necrotize and just straight up decompose within sometimes within like hours or weeks of exposure. Like I've seen a hand that got hit by a concentrated X-ray beam that we use, and it literally just turns black and just starts decaying. Like some necrotic force has just like consumed it. So Chernobyl, not for the faint of heart, a very different type of blood and gore than Game of Thrones.
Does it get really graphic? Or is it the implied graphicness of it?
They actually, I think, have a very balanced hand in how they show it. A lot of the like nuclear reactor technicians and engineers have on like white clothing, and you can tell that they're like, with their intense exposure to radiation, that like blood pools start to appear on their uniforms as their skin is like breaking and their insides are being liquidized and everything. And so you can see that, but you're not seeing any physical gore. But then at another point, there's a firefighter who gets exposed to graphite from the reactor core, and his hand just starts to like immediately melt away from his body. So
a quick step back here. Can you tell us what like the premise of the show is? Cause it's
about
a place,
but
I don't know like at what point in time it's supposed to actually take place in.
Okay. So that is actually a good point. I need the exact date for this.
Is it right after the catastrophe?
It is based upon the catastrophe. So it essentially starts. One second, I need to Google this. It starts at the moment of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I wasn't sure.
1986 is, I believe, when the Chernobyl accident happened. They had one of like four reactor cores explode. And yeah, let's see. And then this is the other thing that's just annoying about about the nomenclature behind radiation, is that there's actually a bunch of different ways to measure radiation. You have Curie's based upon Marie Curie's exposure. And then in this, it has Röntgen, which I don't actually know how to measure Röntgen. So I don't know how they associate. But it released like pretty much the largest amount of radiation, as far as I know, into the world at large. Outside of it released more radiation than I think either of our atomic bombs that we dropped on Japan did. Like the atomic bombs in Japan are actually pretty small in the amount of radiation that was produced at like Hiroshima and Nagasaki compared to what this one Chernobyl reactor core spilled off during its explosion, and then the exposure. They talk about in the show, even at one point, that like the radiation gets so bad that it's detectable in like the Scandinavian countries. Yeah.
Jakes.
It's a very good show. It is a drama. It is very intense. The acting is very good. The accents, what a shame. But
I don't see an issue with it, honestly. I think it's dumber.
No, it's my personal distaste for the accent, which I'll totally admit to.
Yeah, I feel like it's just as contrived, or I mean, I feel like it's like unnecessarily contrived to have a bunch of Russian accents on English speakers for a show that takes place in Russia, which is also why I feel very strangely about the Last Light. No, that's not the series' name. But that's one of the games. 2020.
Oh, Metro.
Metro, thank you. That's why I feel strangely about the English voice acting in Metro.
Do they do Russian accents?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's almost like I just wanted it to be a native English speaker who's doing it instead of a British English speaker. What you're smiling at my use of
just,
native.
It's just one of those things where it's like, I mean, I understand why you'd prefer American English, because like to us, British English sounds, you know,
we're all aware, right, that it's the right way to do it and to pronounce things. Man, I'm killing our international audience, but that's okay. This is the hill that I will die on. I can see why that's awkward, and I think it's even more awkward when it is, I mean, you would find it probably pretty offensive if, let's say, we had actors trying to use accents for people of other origins that have no actual association to that.
It's like, I never find it that offensive, because it's like, accents are funny, and that's just, that's fucking, let's deal with it, right? Like,
yeah.
It's not that big of a deal, but I find it like distasteful if it's not being used in a comical level. If let's say you have a bunch of like actors that are purposely speaking in a Japanese accent to voice a Japanese based game, if that makes sense. But in contrast, like there obviously are uses for accents in films that are more serious. Like if you watch 007 and there's a Russian spy speaking to James Bond, you better believe he should have a slight Russian accent to him. Or he doesn't necessarily have to, but like that gives you extra information about the character that you would not normally get from the script.
Right. And it's also easier because you're imposing that restriction on one actor and not the entire cast and crew, which is also probably fair.
And it's specifically there, like there's a reason for it. But I think we've talked about this with Ghosts of Tsushima before, which I believe uses Japanese actors or voice actors. So I think that kind of like, if that's their natural speaking tone, then there's not much you can do about it, right?
Yeah.
Like it would just be dumb to specifically look for someone that has a strong Japanese accent in that type of game.
I think we also talked about it on the opposite end when we were talking about the anime Terror in Resonance or Terror with Resonance or whatever, where they have some native Japanese voice actors speaking English at one point in time. That is, it is hilariously bad, and I love it, and I much prefer them doing that than having an American voice actor.
Yeah, and a lot of it's just the available assets they have on hand. Like, hey,
exactly,
we could find some guy that actually cannot voice act at all and read some really bad English lines, which will essentially be the same effect if this guy that doesn't speak English at all just reads, you know, enunciations
because they're a good
he has
voice
memorized.
Actor. Yeah.
So.
But that's that. That's what I've been watching. And honestly, most of what I've been doing is watching a lot of good TV when I'm not outdoors right now. So.
See, and here I thought when Neil said you were going to be watching a different show, I thought you had started Good Omens. You were so excited about that.
What's Good Omens?
Good Omens is the Amazon Prime thing. Amazon Prime show? I forget what it's actually about. It's about like an angel and a demon working together to stop the end of the world, starring that one guy who did Hot Fuzz and whatnot. I could have swore it was you that was talking about this as a good book that you read.
Is Hot Fuzz done by the same British comedian that did like Shaun of the Dead and those things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. What's his name?
I'm always curious behind what type of work he does. It's usually decent.
At least I think it was Michael Sheen.
I don't think it's Michael Sheen.
No, it is not. Never mind. Ignore me. Not done by that guy.
Michael
Sheen.
Not Sheen's
done by that guy at all.
Younger, less attractive brother. Older, less
Simon
attractive
Pegg.
Brother.
Yeah, Michael Sheen and Simon Pegg are just faintly familiar, but they are two entirely different people.
It's Simon Pegg.
Yeah, Simon Pegg, also of Run, Fat Boy, Run, Hot Fuzz. What else do we got?
Okay.
Oh, yeah, Star Trek. He plays Scotty in Star
Trek. He really looks like Michael Sheen, honestly.
Yeah, those two look very similar. I cannot burn you on that.
Wait. But Michael Sheen is... Oh, okay. I understand. Simon Pegg is the guy in those comical movies, and Michael Sheen is in Good Omens.
Yeah, and Charlie Sheen is an American actor with no relation to either of them.
Who's good at winning. So no one's been watching Good Omens?
Nope.
No, I have also not been watching Good Omens, but it just premiered and aired on Amazon Prime on Friday the 31st.
Maybe I'll check it out.
It looks really good, just based off of its trailer.
The only Good Omen I've encountered recently is the 8-minute release trailer for Death Stranding.
Transitioning into video games. Yes. Death
if
Stranding.
You want to. Did anyone else feel like it had the same kind of like terminology as a like motivational company PowerPoint? Where it just has like a sentence that is taken out of context, which everything that is made by Kojima that you get a brief insight to is taken out of context of like the larger whole, just seem like outright nonsensical, or they should be on a motivational poster.
I mean, yeah, it's really hard to get the exact tone of this game without playing it, because not only do you have these weird, as you put it, like PowerPoint inserts, although they'd be like from the best PowerPoint presentation I've ever seen, but you also have characters named Die Hard Man and Heart Man.
Half of the guys are named Man, and then there's Sam, and I don't know why they didn't just go for Sam Man.
Well, so and Sam's name is like laughably connected to, or Even the word connected is implied here, because his last name is Bridges.
Yeah.
And his middle name, I think, is also something that is also relevant to the plot, too. And I can't recall what it was. But I digress. It's not really that important. I think the more important thing, though, is that this trailer, like, yes, it implies a lot of world building things that I don't necessarily understand its relevance to the plot. But like, we know America and civilization as a whole has kind of started crumbling. But there's a lot in that trailer that actually lets us see what the game is. And maybe it's because it's like the most relatable product on the market already, but it looks a lot like Metal Gear Solid 5 in terms of controls.
I can see that from based on what has been shown in that trailer of... I'll be honest, I'm not as excited for Death Stranding as you guys are. And I don't think I'll ever be. It still looks like it looks like a magical package delivery game based on like how he was materializing the ladder.
Well, super technological magic. Because the ladder, like, it was definitely everything in the ladder expands out in a way that like a transformer in, you know, becomes a humanoid robot or like changes from a car or a helicopter into a robot, right? So it's like, I don't think they're going for the magic aspect for it there, but it's kind of the nonsensical technology aspect, which is very common for Kojima nanomachines. But I mean, yeah, you say it's like, it looks like a magical delivery man game, and that like, it's funny because you're probably spot on with it, especially with like other words that we're getting that essentially you probably don't want to be in combat because that has consequences. So Stealth Delivery Service is essentially the name of the game. But when you really cut that down further, if you just imagine every Metal Gear Solid game being about delivering packages, it's not all that different, right?
Right, because like, you're sneaking around in a box all the time. You're just outside of the box now. Like, which you gotta used to say that you can't climb into your own backpack as a like way to disguise yourself now.
You could edit the script to essentially be Snake bringing packages to every main character that you have to meet in the game. And it's essentially the exact same gameplay, with the exception of if you get punched, you don't drop one of your packages. Which, you know, and all... like, all points to make here, I just really think that this looks, in a way, exactly like the Fox Engine.
Oh yeah. Just from the fact that the environment seems very interactable.
I'm looking at it from a game design standpoint, and I see the two tools that feel like they'd be overpowered for exploration. You have the magic ladder, as Cookie put it, and you have the climbing rope and hook or whatever, spike, mm-hmm. I guess you could say. There has to be some, like, I don't really think this game's going to be as open
as suggested, what
I'm assuming Red Dead Redemption 2 was. So, like, how do they gate player progress? Do they gate it with magic invisible walls, which would obviously be the worst design and something that we've gotten past, hopefully? Or are they going to gate progress by having mountains that are too tall for your ladder? Like, I'm not sure how else you gate progress into areas you aren't supposed to explore. Because if it is, like, as fully open as Red Dead Redemption 2, it really makes me wonder how they're going to tell a story that, like, how they're going to tell the narrative and story that Kojima is so famous for in his games.
Audio logs scattered as far as the eye can see.
You know, that's the one thing that I think people should be taking to heart here, is that we did not see any sort of tape playing devices, right? Am I wrong?
I don't know. There was plenty of package areas that could have fit on that on the motorcycle he was riding for a little bit there.
He could have a radio. It's future technology. He could just have an earbud that we didn't see.
Well, he does have a radio because he's talking to what we would imagine is mission control.
Yeah.
In a past trailer where he's telling, like, they're asking him what his status is, and he says, "Not good. Rain's not going to stop. There's going to be people that find me here." And then he goes out and gets caught. Like, so he has communications with the Campbell sound alike and whoever else is his support team, probably Hartman. But, like, I don't know. So I actually, a day before this trailer, the most recent trailer showed up, I was telling Tiffany that, like, I honestly don't know how excited I am for this game. Like, it kind of goes up and down during these dead periods of no information. And after watching this trailer, like, my excitement has skyrocketed just because I know what the game is to some extent. And it's stealth, and it's traversal and exploration.
It's not a stealth game, though. Like, he's said that explicitly, that it's not a stealth game.
He says
and
that.
Then you're, and then you're hiding in the like, tall grass.
You say that, but this is a different kind of stealth. It's basically ghost stealth. Like, okay, so you didn't play Deadly Premonition, but it plays off of, like, this trope, this Japanese and Chinese ghost trope, which is essentially that, again, depending on what type of yokai or spirit you're facing, if they can't hear you, they can't see you. And this is absolutely what's happening in a lot of these cutscenes, where you see Norman Reedus and other characters cover their mouth, just like you do in Deadly Premonition. You cover your mouth to avoid ghosts or spirits finding you. So, like, yes, he says it's not a stealth game or whatever bullshit he wants to spew off. He also said that Phantom Pain wasn't Metal Gear Solid 5, by the way, and it was from Moby Dick Studios. So, like, let's remember that Kojima is
You're calling him a liar. That's
he basically just said Kojima's a liar.
But
Kojima will lie to your face for his game.
But when you tell me that, one, you're not supposed to engage in combat, or you're not supposed to kill people, at least, and two,
and he's got lots of punching,
that if you get caught by these ghosts, that they make a crater after they consume and kill you or something, like, despite death not being a permanent state in this game, like, you actually apparently do something to resurrect yourself in some way. Mm-hmm. It certainly seems like death is viewed upon as being a very bad thing, obviously.
Well, it looks like Norman Reedus when he's gray in the trailer, like, he's all gray. It looks like he shoots himself in the head, doesn't he?
Yes.
Do you die to get out of death? Is that the trick? Like, there's a really, really great Extra Fabulous comic about this where a guy's like, ah, oh, fuck this shit. He snaps his own neck and he appears in hell. And then they're like, hey, welcome to hell. It's not so. And then he's like, fuck this. And he snaps his neck again and he ends up in a different place. It's really, really good.
I mean,
that sounds wonderful.
There's a possibility that he shoots himself in the head there in some sequence to go back to the quote-unquote land of the living. There's also a possibility that, like, he's in a weird situation which he has to use the death mechanic as a way to progress or, you know, get out of something. It's very interesting. I also wonder if Sam is the only person with this power, or if the other people that he accompanies also have these powers as well. Like in past trailers, we see at least two other people that are traveling with him.
And it also sounded like the group that he was going against that they were talking about in the trailer,
the religious creating cult.
Yeah, they were creating craters. And I'm thinking that means just anyone who's caught by these things can create a crater. And as long as you're the one who's caught, you don't die, but everyone else around you may die.
It's interesting. And then
it's a Kojima enough thought process, though, right?
I mean, yeah, very well could be. It's really hard with, like, all of this quote unquote concrete information and nomenclature that we have in this most recent trailer to, like, try and fit some of that back to some of the previous theories, too. Like, we now know the other side is Hades, so it's hell. Or at least some form or ideal of it. The babies are also represent a connection to the other side. So maybe you're carrying around hell babies in this whole game. Who fucking knows? I'm excited.
They like to go by purgatory babies.
Are they purgatory babies?
There's a plastic pseudo baby that seems to also be in the same kind of space at the end of the trailer, which is weird.
Yeah,
that was weird.
It's not Silent Hill 5 or Silent Hills, as it was also coined. But I think this is like a good not Metal Gear Solid, but like maybe psychological horror mixed in with that sort of game. So I'm looking forward to it.
Speaking of looking forward to things and being excited, that one company got me again, guys. They got me again.
Which company is this?
Fucking Call of Duty, Modern Warfare.
No, you already own that game. You've played that game a lot already. I know you
but
have.
But now it looks gooder.
But it was good when it first came out. Like, if there's a Call of Duty game I'm going to give credit to for being awesome, I thought Modern Warfare was amazing. That was the fourth Call of Duty. It was probably my favorite one, and I must have played that campaign like 3 or 4 times. I didn't even play the multiplayer that much. Good game.
They're redoing it.
All done. I finished it, though. I beat the game. I did it.
But they're redoing it.
But I don't need to pay them $60 to play the same game.
I'm excited again.
Actually, I'm sorry. I withdraw all of this criticism because I'm an asshole who's going to buy Link's
Skyrim
Awakening.
Again?
No, not Skyrim again.
Yeah, but Link's Awakening has like actual issues with the game that could be easily
fixed. And it's a completely different... Maybe if they made the next Call of Duty with a completely different animation or design style, that might be worth it. Because it Link's Awakening is going to be like this almost claymation-looking stuff. Which is cool.
Yeah. It's like if Modern Warfare became VR, good VR.
Yeah,
that's essentially the jump that Link's Awakening is making here.
Maybe that's what their fourth mode is going to be. Third mode is going to be, because they're not doing zombies. Maybe they'll have a VR mode.
Something tells me one of those modes is going to be a Battle Royale mode, right?
Nope. They've already confirmed no Battle Royale.
That's, I don't know. I don't know about that, man.
Not everyone's Kojima, man. Not everyone's Kojima. But nah, it got me excited for the reboot because, yeah, it was a good game. And this was actually one of the few Call of Duties Lizzie did not play.
Oh, so you'll be able to get some... It'll be a new game to her, essentially.
And a new game to me, just based off of what they're doing with this story. Basically, they said they're reimagining the story of the Call of Duty thing because they're like, it got a little too out of hand. They're going to base it more in reality now.
So that's interesting, at least. Like, it's a whole new rewrite.
Yeah. And it looks so delicious. Oh, so good. So, yeah. They got me excited. I'm going to make a mistake. I know I'm going to make a mistake. And it comes out in October.
Well, speaking of realism, real world mechanics and everything, I've been playing some Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney.
What?
Which have either of you guys played those games before?
My sister has, I've watched her play it.
I have watched the first couple episodes of the anime. So, and I've played Marvel vs. Capcom 3.
I got to point out, like, everyone seems to hate the anime, so it's another one of those, like, A1 Productions bullshit jobs I think they've done. So be wary, that might not actually represent the style of, or the, you know, the quality of the gameplay and script. But I'm actually not here to talk about how much I'm enjoying Phoenix Wright, because I'm actually kind of adverse to the experience thus far. I've gotten through two cases. And the second case, I think, is kind of a two-parter. And what the... this is some type of dystopian bullshit country that they live in. Because the court system and the way trials are held are bullshit. So...
Objection!
I mean...
Overruled!
I mean, just the aspect of, like, there's actually... There's no semblance of this game to, like, a real court case.
No, absolutely not.
You're looking for the person to make a mistake and call them out on it.
So okay. So here's the first thing. All right, I feel like Phoenix Wright doesn't know how to do pre-case prep.
Oh God, no! Why would he know how to do that?
but in addition to that, the thing that gets me is that you basically, in the midst of all of these cases, I believe the trend is basically that your client is always innocent, and the person that's guilty is going to be one of the witnesses because they're dumb enough to be like, you know where I should be as the guilty person in this trial, or the actual crook? I should be testifying.
I'm not exactly sure why you think that's a bad idea. It's like, okay, I don't want to go down for this crime. The only way I can guarantee it is if I pin somebody else down. So I just have to blame them. I just have to point and say, it wasn't me, it was that guy. This is
so
obviously that guy.
Pussycatcher on the counter?
Wasn't me.
Wasn't me. So I started playing these games because essentially I'm really into Danganronpa. And that, like, that game is like half visual novel adventure, and the other half is essentially debates trying to figure out who killed someone.
Isn't it also an unfair judicial system?
Yes, but the context in Danganronpa is that they're in a very unfair situation that is not supposed to represent a legal system to begin with.
But I also think that strikes too true for Ace Attorney and for our modern judicial system in the States. So
political commentary here, but like the way these court systems and these trials are run are ridiculous. Like, okay, what shouldn't happen? And maybe, like, I just need to get off of my high horse of like, this isn't realistic. But it just troubles me so much because I'm sure maybe in some way it reflects our actual justice system, as you imply. But the one thing that really caught me off guard is in the first case, and as it seems to be a trend at this point, in the first case, once you're only able to deliver the verdict of innocence for your client by basically proving someone else in the courtroom has done it. And once you prove that, then they're found guilty. Like, they don't get their own trial or anything. But, like, that
they're
alone
just immediately
doesn't really,
busted, yeah.
That doesn't necessarily, like, bug me that much. But it's just the nature of the game. It, like, Danganronpa also has this problem, but I think less so, in that Phoenix Wright doesn't know how to address multiple problems at once. He's only presented one thing, and... like he and the game are only looking for one answer or one flaw, and oftentimes in your evidence, like the evidence you have or that you're given and the issues with their testimonies amount to like several different problems, but the game like doesn't know how to handle other problems or other issues with the testimony being brought up. Instead, like, it is only looking for the one thing, and if you don't get the one thing, you're at a standstill. In addition to that, the other thing I found is that like this game is much less about actually setting up what happens, which is something you do in Danganronpa, which is infinitely like more satisfying, and instead you basically just listen to testimony and point out flaws. It's the objection system, as you put it. Mm-hmm. And that's really all you do for the majority of the court cases.
Isn't that how court works?
Well, I think Neil's pointing out the weakness of the game, that you have to follow this linear path of debunking instead of being able to take multiple routes to debunking something, or of just refutation, you could do, what is it? Like in a more flexible scenario, you could just have like confirmation of alibi or something. But this game is all about like, oh no, they don't have an alibi, so you have to prove this other person wrong and lying. And then also while you do that, you have to be like, not only are they lying, is that a bloody dagger hanging out of their pocket? And then the court turns and gasps and says, oh my gosh, did you take that from our defendant? And then you have to prove that they didn't take it from the defendant, but they actually walked it in earlier today, and that the hair on it belongs to the victim that they just stabbed in front of the courthouse while they were pointing at the other person like, I can't believe they did that. Did you see them kill this person?
It gets ridiculous, to say the least. The other issues I have with it are that the judge is just a fucking idiot. Like...
they even give him an idiot face look for certain...
every time you refute a testimony and prove it wrong, the judge then gives the witness like a second, third, fourth, and fifth chance in some cases to like figure out their testimony again. It's like, well, okay, we have completely annihilated the witness's credibility here. And yet we're still going to let their testimony stand as being a plausible thing. And again, I probably wouldn't have these issues if like they did a better job of representing that, like the nation that they live in, be it America or Japan or whatever, is super fucked. But they don't really do a good job of establishing that. And maybe they do later. I don't know. But like they're totally in some dystopian bullshit society. And then the other thing that gets me is that for what I've seen so far, it seems like you always know who actually did it. Like the opening of each case or of each chapter literally shows you the person that gets killed and who kills them. So there's never an element of twist involved in you discovering that someone that you didn't suspect to be the killer turns out to be the killer. And I think like that has done maybe a disservice to the quality of the first two cases or trials, at least, because there was no element of surprise. So ultimately, the only emotion driving me forth was not about discovery, or that was not one of the emotions I was that was driving me forward. It was just trying to prove that this court system is a fucking sham. But I digress. It's not like I'm just hating it. It's just sort of like a love hate. Like I'm loving to hate this game so far. And maybe my feelings and affections will change. And maybe that's what it is. It's the Seinfeld effect. You know, like, you watch Seinfeld because they're shitty people. You don't watch them because you want to be the characters in Seinfeld. To my surprise, I've also been playing another game. I've been playing Total War Three Kingdoms. Like, so...
Wait, you've been playing it?
Yeah. I've been seeing a lot of streamers that, like, do not play these types of games playing it, and I'm wondering if they're endorsed advertisements or endorsed streams or whatnot. And I haven't really jumped that far into watching any of those, but I've been playing this quite a bit. Total War Three Kingdoms. It's a Total War game, so it's pretty janky. And there are things that could be better explained, but their tutorials are never amazing. And maybe they're hidden behind text walls, but dude, who really wants to go through the text wall when there are actually voice tutorials as well? But yeah, it's pretty good. I don't think it's worth investing in immediately if you're just like a strategy fan. I think it's one of those games that you can just kind of pick up when you know, down the road if it's on sale. But this one being Three Kingdoms and China based, I'm a huge fan of that period of history or fiction in some cases. And the one thing I really did appreciate about this game too is that the different leaders or factions that you can play actually seem to really force different play styles. So of the three kingdoms that there are that people would potentially be familiar with, there's Cao Cao, there's Sun Jian, and then there's Liu Bei. And I've played Cao Cao and Sun Jian quite a bit. Sun Jian, whatever. And I loved how the game really pushes you to play these two characters differently. Cao Cao has essentially a meter that's essential. I think it's labeled integrity. So he starts off with like medium integrity. And the idea is that, like, because Cao Cao is in like a highly populated and contested area with a lot of like nobles and lords, his integrity drops if you start attacking people, but it raises through peace. So you have to be more diplomatic and you have to scheme more as Cao Cao if you want to gain power immensely. Whereas Sun Jian, on the other hand, I don't remember what his meter is called, but basically the titles or levels that you have for the meter essentially label how much of a badass he is. Like, he's the tiger, or these are not true, but like the historic name is he's the tiger of Shangdong, I believe that is. I believe it's something like that. So that's what he's called if his meter's at the highest. Oh, it's heroism. So you raise that bar by just literally attacking people, and you keep attacking people. And if, when in doubt, you should probably go attack more people. So my two saves over these two different characters are completely different. Like, at one point, or with Sun Jian, I'm like expanding my borders and trying to just fight everyone with just a little bit of caution into whether or not I can hold old territories. And sometimes I just give them up because it's much more beneficial for me to take new land, get a higher bar, and reclaim that stuff later when, you know, when my main army's more towards that area. And with Cao Cao, it's the exact opposite. I'm biding my time. I'm trying to get small advantages with potential allies or potential enemies that I'm trying to fool into thinking I'm their ally, only to like make broad, big pushes at once to try and minimize the effect it has towards my integrity.
And also, do you feel more incentivized too to take care of any land that you've obtained?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because if I lose something, like it's not like the EU4 system where you have right to claim that land back. Like, if I'm fighting over a port and I keep losing that port, I'm going to lose integrity by taking that port back, I believe, at least. So it means I have to play like a much more defensive and calm, calculated game. Which I just wanted to point it out because this particular element to the Three Kingdoms era and all of the games it encompasses has never really been illustrated in a better way. Other games really just rely on the stats and the like the expertise of your characters. So you might have a faction with a bunch of people with high war stats, meaning that you can, you know, fight a lot and do well. But like, quite honestly, you could take the faction known for being peaceful and having a high governing and intelligence stat for most of their officers and just brute force your wars, you know, or hire high war generals. And the play style really never has to reflect the faction you're playing with. And while, like, at first I thought it was kind of limiting because I would much rather play as Wu and be more cautious and conservative, which is ultimately going to drop my bar to the point where it might be like extreme hard mode. I find that like the act of playing out of your comfort zone is actually extremely rewarding too. So Three Kingdoms, good game, okay game, around there. Like I'm at 3 out of 5 right now for it right now. Last but not least, I also have been playing Persona 3 Portable. It's another version of Persona 3 in which you can play a female protagonist. Just real quickly, I just really want to bring this up quickly because I think I've talked illy about it in the past, but I've been putting more time in it, and I've actually been enjoying this version of Persona 3 quite a bit more. For perspective, since I know you guys have played Persona 5 with its confidant system, the thing about Persona 3 is that you actually didn't have social links or confidant meetings with a lot of your party members. The only party members you could actually hang out with were the girls, and that was because you were going to date them, essentially. But so it'd be like playing Persona 5, except you can't hang out with Ryuji or Yusuke or your cat.
Which
Morgana.
Yusuke was the best dates, so
Yusuke's the best husbando. You know, let's be real.
Best husbando. Best husbando of P5.
But
best waifu of P5 too, actually. Shit. Fuck it.
But so in Persona 3 Portable, I don't know if it's just if you play as the girl or if you play as either the guy and girl. Probably not the guy because he already has specific confidants, quote unquote, or social links for those arcana. But when you play as the girl, you actually get to have those social links with all of, like, with every character in your party, guy or girl, and it's not necessarily implied romances either, which is one of the problems about Persona 3 is that you date everyone and you kind of feel like a scumbag.
Do you though?
Yeah, absolutely. But the reason why I want to bring this up though is that in P3, like, the cast on the guy side especially is really underdeveloped at points. Like, you have a guy that's a boxer, and he's really single dimensional. He wants to get strong and he talks about protein. Then you have Junpei, who's essentially like the goof off character, the Ryuji, and he really just seems kind of like an asshole. And aside from being the class clown, he's an asshole. And then he falls in love with one of the antagonists. And that's kind of his story arc. But when you start hanging out with them in P3P, you actually start to learn more about his past. You learn about his father, who's an alcoholic and abusive. And I bring that up very lightly, but it's not really treated in that way either. It takes a more serious tone with it too, without making it like overbearing either. But I just really appreciate that the game actually does a really good job of characterizing some of these teammates that you really didn't get much context to in the past. And the other thing that really jumped out at me was that a lot of the details I'm getting from Persona 3 Portable actually are, I guess, referenced to in Persona 3 Dancing in Moonlight. Like specifically the reference to his father is brought up and some other things that make me feel justified for playing Persona 3 Portable now on the girl's side. And I know that the female protagonist also shows up in Persona Q too. So I guess all I'm saying is that if you listened to me in the past and thought P3P was not worth playing because of the visual novel presentation, I think I take that all back. The visual novel menu system is also, like, granted it sucks that you're not running around, but let's be real, Persona 3 doesn't really age as well as the other games when it comes to the city traversal and so forth. And the menu traversal system that they have in P3P speeds up the game dramatically too. So I'm finding myself much further in the game than I would have been if I were playing Persona 3 Vanilla 4 or 5. So thumbs up. I'm enjoying it. And that's nice. What I've been playing.
I'm glad someone's been playing video games for the video game podcast.
Yep. Yep. Video games. They exist.
They're our bread and butter, yeah. Just not this week.
Or last week, really.
It's summer. It's so much harder. It's easy when I'm locked indoors during the winter because it's either go outside and freeze to death or stay inside and play a game and drink tea.
Once I get this deck built, or the stairs on and this deck being built, I'll be back at it playing video games again, having them exist.
And I need Fire Emblem to come out.
Three Houses? Isn't that November or October?
Yeah, it's a while, so I need something else to come out before it, too.
Have you already picked out which waifu you're going after, as represented by the house?
Oh, yeah, democracy. There's two, essentially, like, there's an empire, a monarchy, and a democracy.
What color?
Yeah, I think it's yellow. I think it's the deer house. It's Hufflepuff.
Oh, okay.
It's a character conflict for me because that's not normally I normally am very anti-Hufflepuff, but democracy is the only way.
Ouch, I'm very Hufflepuff. Anyway.
I'm just excited for when they announce the fourth house, the true house.
The greenhouse.
The greenhouse
effect. The sea people. The greenhouse effect, yeah. There's a small industrial country like on an island just off the coast, and they plan on just wrecking the continent with their like carbon emissions.
By their industrialism.
Yeah.
And in fact, they make sneakers, and their factory emits the most pollution you've ever seen.
I wanted to say that while everyone else has their medieval fantasy technology, they're just straight up building tanks. Like they're a port in from Advance Wars, and they have like the Neo tanks just rolling across the ocean.
The game becomes Valkyria Chronicles.
Oh, holy shit! Yes, that's perfect. I forgot that there is already precedent to mash all of these things together.
You want waifus and you want tanks? Valkyria Chronicles. It even has magical girls in it, too, with transformations.
Can't they all be the same thing? Can't your tank be a waifu?
Okay, so I joked about the green choice, but when I'm going through the screenshots on Nintendo.com, there's quite literally a girl with green hair.
Yeah, well, it's Fire Emblem. They all have weird hair colors. I feel like that's not a great indicator. But it's also Fire Emblem, and the last two Fire Emblem games that we've played have split into, like, choose your faction in this, like, instead of shoehorning you into a single faction, it's like, choose this faction between option A or option B. And then they're like, here's the DLC, here's option C. In this game, they're like, here's A, B, and C. And they're like holding D back. They're like, don't worry, we're going to make you $60 too.
Right.
So, I mean, there will be a fourth house, most likely. It'll erupt out of the center of the continent and just push the other three houses out of the way. And it's going to be fascinating.
Just a real quick question. Do you really think that the three choices are going to be that light and dark? Like democracy is going to be the good side, empire is the bad side?
No, I don't think so, but we all know that democracy is the guiding light for any stable peace, right? Is that still true? I'm looking around the room. Maybe it's not.
Japan still has an emperor, you know?
Yeah, but he's super chill, and he's abdicating the throne. Actually, he just finished abdicating the throne to his son or grandson, I think.
The way you say that, it's like he might abdicate later too, who knows.
Well, it's one of those things where like they've gotten to the point where it's the representative monarchy, right? Just like the UK,
yeah,
where it's just like, here's a figurehead who collects public taxes, which I think is bad, and they get to live a life of luxury while they also have to do none of the governing. It's like we essentially have purchased a person whose bloodline makes them very good at waving at parades.
God, I would love to be in that bloodline.
Yeah right.
Wouldn't we all? But yeah, that's it. I'm just saying that I think that my yellow deer are going to be pure of heart. And it makes me a little sad because I think the red girl is an axe wielder. And axe wielders, I think, are severely underrated in Fire Emblem because they always suck early game. And then by the late game, they just do like an obscene amount of damage compared to any other unit. I think it's Fire Emblem The Sacred Stones where you get a journeyman character named Ross, who's one of those like... You essentially have your like first class and then second class units, right? So the first class is the 1 to 20, and then the second class is technically 21 to 40. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
But then you have these, what I call them baby classes, which has like Amelia or Ross or I forget what the name of the little mage is. I think it's Ewan. They're like, I think it's a 1 to 10 or maybe even a 1 to 20. So technically those characters can reach stats of like a level 60 character instead of a level 40. And you can beat the final boss in Sacred Stones with just Ross as like a berserker in like two hits. I've done it. He crits and this health bar that's supposed to be massive and an unknown amount just goes whoop right down to zero and the game's over. So axe users are severely underrated because they have terrible hit rates for the first like 60% of the game.
If we all end up... Wait a second. Is there a choosable gender in this game?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, I have not been keeping up with the...
cover art,
with the character customization.
Well, the cover in general, I guess. Are we all three playing this?
Yeah, I think so.
Sure, Tricky? Why not?
Well, I mean, I don't want to force you to, but if we do,
everybody stakes a different house.
Yeah, maybe we do that.
I'm calling a red axe house.
Oh, son of a gun! I take edge lords.
You have
wand
to
kid.
Blue spear, or maybe he has a sword. I think maybe yellow is the spear user. Long
no,
story
yellow's
short,
bow.
Yellow's
bow.
Yellow's bow. That works for me.
Blue is spear.
I don't want to fucking deal with social knights or whatever
maybe
you call them in the
social links
releases. What's that?
Social links?
No,
social
no.
Knights. What it,
so like Fire Emblem 4, the translation that they used was social knights, were like your knights that that could use spear and sword.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very weird. But yeah, I'm assuming that's what Blue's going to be, a bunch of fucking knights.
Oh, yeah, you're going to get the general class where they can use, like, all three, or
it's just such
a
boring class, because, like, that's essentially been the Fire Emblem cast through one through whatever game stopped using them.
One of us has to play a female, and normally, in most games, I'm totally comfortable, if not more disposed, to create a female protagonist instead of a male one. Mass Effect especially, because I just like the voice actress better. But Fire Emblem is the one game where I will normally make a male custom created character because I can do the like sleepy Brock eyes where they're not even open. And I just always try and make sure that my character has the laziest personality. He's just a dude who can't even be bothered to open his eyes. I am afraid I will have to stick to that default for this game as well.
We'll see how I feel going into it. All right.
I'll more than likely do female.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Cookie.
I said I'll more than likely make a female. I usually make a female character.
I guess with all that said, is there anything else you guys want to go over before ending this podcast?
Nope.
Then that does it for this episode of Fancy Ramen, episode 120. You can write into podcast@fancyramen.com with questions, comments, or corrections.
Don't be afraid to look out for our streams. Neo does under twitch.com/fancyramentv. You can find me at /cookieskamilk and John at jfrayallday.
Hey, how do you spell cookieskamilk?
CUKISKMILK. The only way to spell it.
I don't know if you saw, but one of our last emails had cookie spelled out like the confection.
Yeah, COOKIE.
They knew the old me, not the new me.
this is post rebrand. We did do that like $3 million rebrand, and so you do need to start respecting the new color scheme that we've added and the new spelling.
If you haven't noticed, I haven't been wearing my signature robe. Rebrand.
I know. Yeah, rebrand. And please tell your three closest friends that all govern their own kingdoms to listen to the Fancy Ramen podcast. Nothing can bring together warring nations better than video game and media content.
I'm Cookie, spelled with a C-U-K-I.
I'm Scott, spelled with an S.
I'm Neil, spelled with a K.
have a good weekend, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.